three jolts of the hammer. First thing is cell phone issues. If you have cell phones, good idea to extinguish their ability to make noises. Because I don't know if I've done mine yet. Better check. Welcome to Resources. Certainly happy to have the commissioner and some other adventurous people here. Kevin. Present before us today is Representative Guttenberg, Representative Coring, Representative Seaton, Representative Roses, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gatto. Today we've got a couple hours to talk to the administration. The administration has obviously some slides behind us and a PowerPoint presentation. I've asked them to be as streamlined as possible, since so many of us, especially Representative Coring and Kawasaki, if he was here, have been through weeks of this, and we've all been through months of this, and I think we're at that level where we may not be in the major leagues, but we're certainly not in the minor leagues either on this issue. So with that, Commissioner Pat Galvin, introduce yourself and who you work for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The people.
My name is Pat Galvin. I'm Commissioner of Revenue. I work for the people of Alaska, as we all do. Thank you for the opportunity to present the AGIA bill to the committee. As the Chairman noted, we will try to just focus upon a few key issues that we know are on your radar screen, and things that we know are the subject of a lot of discussion, and we'll try to streamline this discussion to those specific points rather than going into a broad overview of the bill.
Could I interrupt question right already? Off the bat? Representative Roses has a question.
Just a procedural thing.
Certainly.
Did you want us to go through questions as we go through this, have any, or do you want to wait till the end?
No, that's the way we've been doing it all along. I think that's
wanted
the most
to verify
helpful.
And just for the record, even though you are asking for an abbreviated presentation, I appreciate that, but not everybody on this committee has had the experience of 3 weeks of this. So
we're making assumptions.
And some of those assumptions are accurate. I have read through it and gone through it quite a bit. I have staff that have been attending the oil and gas meetings, but just didn't want it to be understood that everybody in the committee had that exposure.
Appreciate that. I think probably by abbreviated was somewhat, you know, can we accelerate the pace rather than Representative Edgman has just joined us. And Mr. Commissioner?
Yes.
Thank
and
you.
Just to clarify, I think the way that we have anticipated this opportunity is primarily to answer questions and to have the committee members direct the conversation to the areas that you have interest in. We're trying to minimize the level of our sort of direction in terms of what we want you to focus on, and allow the committee to ask questions upon any aspect of the bill that you'd like us to pursue. I don't know. I'm sort of noticing that we don't have the cameras here. We don't.
That's
I don't
right.
Know
if it's getting to a certain
point in the process where we're no longer.
I know. We don't have to. All the questions.
I recognize there's still a microphone here, so I have to be careful about that.
All the questions can be sincere and.
I also what it makes me wonder is we had to joke them because we've got the on the Senate or on the other body's side we have a committee hearing going on simultaneously, so the team had to split and
where the cameras are.
Everybody's guessing which is the A team, which one's the B team, and we're trying not to.
That's not
have
a confusion
that.
In this room.
I like that.
You get the A team. There's no confusion there, at least as far as we're concerned. Again, what we'll be doing is I'll give just a sort of a brief synopsis of our philosophy and what drove us to the bill and the structure that we have. We've got Kevin Banks from Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas, who will be discussing certain aspects of the bill as it relates to the leasing program and the state's interest in oil and gas. We have Don Shepler, an attorney from Greenberg Traurig, who has been a consultant. He had worked with the legislature last year, and he's been working with us on the development of the AGIA bill, and he'll be discussing certain aspects of the FERC areas of the bill and provide you with some more detailed information. Again, what we have in the slides in particular are mostly summary statements. You can rest assured that a lot of the slides are built upon a tremendous amount of modeling and research that goes into them, and for any member who wishes to either discuss that privately or at the committee, we're happy to bring that information as well. But for today's purposes, we're focusing on some of the summary aspects of
Representative Kawasaki has joined us, and then a question for you. Has this ever been presented before, this set?
No, this was completed about 15 minutes ago. We're trying to shape it.
It's still warm.
Oh, yes, it is. We're trying to shape it for where we are in the process. As you indicated, we don't feel we need to go back through the whole bill again. So we're trying, again, to shape it towards some of the questions that we've heard, concerns that have been raised, and try to keep basically the conversation moving ahead as opposed to recycling the same issues. So getting started, what we'd like to recognize and have the committee recognize is that AGIA is designed to be a commercial vehicle for the opportunity to create a competitive environment that the commercial players can make their own independent decisions on how to participate and let the creative juices of the commercial world come up with solutions to the issues that face us on this project. And it's focused on moving the project ahead because it's in Alaska's interest to get the pipeline sooner and to have certain terms embedded in it. In order to do this as a government, and to be responsive to the people of the state, we have to do it in as transparent a manner as possible. So we focused both the decision-making process on the concept of transparency, but also when we talk about the inducements that Alaska is willing to put forward in order to get that creative and competitive environment going, we wanted those to be as transparent as possible as well, so folks know what is being offered by the state and what the ultimate price tag of those inducements are going to be, that we walk into this with our eyes wide open in terms of what risks and what costs the state is taking on. It's important to note that this is not a negotiation. We hear a lot of discussion about some people saying that the state should be negotiating with the producers or certain parties. AGIA is not designed to be a negotiation in the sense of sitting down in a room away from the public and trying to hash out all the details of a pipeline, as was tried during the Stranded Gas Development Act. The AGIA model is to create a bidding opportunity through the request for application process that allows all the competing proposals to come forward and to provide the state with a picture of what opportunities we have among the competing interests. We have inducements in the bill in order to create that competition, to try to get as much interest in this project and to get those commercial players willing to step forward and do the things that the state wants them to do, which is move the project ahead, give us a timeline for that movement, commit to certain requirements, have an open season, commit to going to a certificate, and to meet the terms that we'll be talking about shortly. In order to get those, we have a midstream inducement of a potentially $500 million capital contribution. And when I say potentially, I mean that we're going to get proposals back, and they will reflect the level to which they expect the state to participate, and that will be contingent, we expect, on how the project proceeds. And so what when we talk about transparency of the inducement, what we're saying is we don't necessarily know how much that contribution is going to be at this point. But what we do know is that it's not going to exceed $500 million. And so that is a very important aspect of AGEA, that we are saying that the state has a limit on what our exposure is on this venture. We also include upstream inducements on tax and royalty issues that are geared towards a certain action that we're trying to, again, induce, which is make a commitment to the licensed project at the initial open season. Again, we're trying to design those so that they're clear, transparent, people know what is actually being offered, and we know it now as we begin to move down the road of the AGEA process. It's important to just, again, we sometimes find ourselves comparing to the stranded gas contract. And the one comparison I'd like to make is just with regard to that transparency issue. There was a lot of concern voiced in the public about the process that was used in developing that contract, the sense that it was done away from the public view, that it was a closed-door negotiation, that it was not open and competitive, and that is a concern that we're trying to address. Similarly, there is a tremendous concern voiced about the cost, the risks, the ultimate price tag that the state was going to have to pay under that contract, that it was there's a lot of hidden costs associated with that, a lot of things that were not quantifiable. And what we're trying to do with the AGEA process is to eliminate that level of uncertainty associated with that cost to the state. And so the inducements that we're including here are quantifiable, they're known from the beginning, and the process is as transparent as possible. Within
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On your previous slide there, I guess one of the concerns that I've heard is that in the upstream inducements, you know, I mean, we've heard from time immemorial here that we've worked on this, is uncertainty is the the big problem and looking for certainty. And, you know, I'm really concerned that we have a hugely uncertain thing of saying, well, whatever the tax rate, the difference between the tax rate is now and the tax rate then is going to be something, but we don't know what that tax rate is going to be. And it seems to me that one of the big components of this process is to get partners to the table, get gas in the open season, get bids made, and if we wait until open season for people to even know what the tax rate is, we're not going to have them as partners coming forward and building in a application for or working together with other partners to put this together. And so you know, I think that we basically have the most expertise we're ever going to have on what PPT was and how the tax program was put together and what it means at this time in the legislature. Wait 3 years, I think it's 36 months in here or something. We're going to have a lot of new players that won't have been around, that won't have gone through that situation. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out why we don't give some certainty by figuring out what that tax rate is that's going to apply, and so that people can actually make an open and honest decision as to whether they want to partner and apply.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, there's two aspects that I'd like to address. The first one has to do with the need for getting the tax rate set before the applications are due. Clearly, with regard to the action that we're trying to induce, the upstream inducements are set towards, it's to get a commitment at the open season. And so the concept behind the current structure of the bill is that it's the tax rate that's in place when they make that decision that's going to drive them into a decision on whether to commit or not, and that they don't need to know it years in advance because they're not going to make that decision until they actually make that commitment. I understand the logic of the argument that if we could set the tax rate before the applications are due, that we may, I haven't heard the producers say that they would not submit an AG application because the tax rate's not set until open season. But I can understand it as a potential sort of logical extension of something that they may say. But we have two concerns there. One is, can you lock it in at that point? There's a lot of discussion about the constitutionality of locking in the tax rate. We believe that we have our strongest argument for doing so in the bill based upon the exchange of making the gas commitment in exchange for locking in the rate that's at that time. They basically get that exchange at that moment when they make that commitment. And the mechanism by that we would lock in the rate at the time the applications are due isn't necessarily there because we're not asking them to commit their gas at that time. When they submit an application, they don't have to commit their gas as part of their application. And so we don't have that same immediate exchange that would lock in that contractual relationship. The second part, and then if you can't lock it in then, if the actual application doesn't lock it in, then it could easily be changed by the legislature between that point and open season, and it's a question of what have you actually provided if you did set something. The second part of the answer goes to some extent, what you said regarding the expertise that we have now, that now is the time because we've got the level of knowledge at a point where we can deal with this issue. And frankly, we really don't have we're not at the right point now because, I mean, speaking personally, we just got back our first returns on PPT less than a week ago. And we're still assessing those. There was a gap between what we expected and what we received. And we're going to have to take some time to figure out why that is and whether or not the PPT, the way it's structured right now, is going to be expected to deliver what it was expected to deliver. When you turn that focus, and that's just on the oil side, when you turn that focus around to the gas side, we have to develop a lot more information on the gas side than we currently have, and more than what we developed. The PPT discussion previously was focused primarily on oil. It didn't get into a great deal of specifics about the gas side. And that's part of the problem right now, is that people recognize that the gas tax rate wasn't the focus of the discussion a year ago, and so maybe it needs to be put in greater focus. And we need to get some more information before we're going to be ready to have that discussion to the point where we're confident that we're setting a rate that can be locked in for potentially, if we lock it in now, we're looking at 10, 15, upwards of 20 years that we're committing to that rate. And I think we want to have a little bit more information about what the appropriate rate should be before we would take on that commitment. Now, all that said, I think that it's worthwhile to discuss whether or not we need to have a discussion between now and our current target date for applications being due is October 1st. Whether we need to have some time between now and then to reopen the discussion on PPT gas rate. But for the purposes of AGEA, we feel very strongly that we need to get this bill passed we need to get the process started before we would add in the extra complication associated with setting the gas tax rate in this bill.
I'm just going to ask you to add something. That, just because you brought it up, the anticipated return was less than, I'm sorry, the real return was less than the anticipated return by a certain amount of money. But the return itself was for 9 months, 10 months, 12 months?
Right, it was for April through December, so 8 months.
So 8 months, and how many dollars was it?
$813 million.
So $813 million over 8 months is about $100 million a month. Over 12 months would be $1.2 billion. And that is closer to what the PPT essentially has produced.
Mr. Chair, the expectation for what PPT was going to produce for that period of time was approximately $950 million. And that was the model that was used for the evaluation on what the appropriate rate should be. And the expectation was it was going to result in a payment of $950 million. Instead, we got $813 million.
You're talking just the 8 months?
Over that 8 month period. And so there is a
shortfall.
There's a disconnect between what was expected and what was received. And so all I'm suggesting is we need to know more about why that happened before we start locking in some of these things for an extended period of time.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, how much adjustments is there because of the spill up there and we shut things down and they slowly went going again?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. That's part of the analysis. The $950 million expectation was after the spill had occurred, after the production shortfall had taken place, and so that factored that in, and so that wasn't the direct cause, but the relationship between costs and production is a big part. I mean, it's an additional complication from what we've had to deal with before, and so it's something that we're having to look at more closely.
Okay. Sorry about that, but I guess we can go back to a G and L.
But it, I mean, they're
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you. And I can appreciate part of that. Part of it is also that we're never going to have experience of gas until gas is flowing. I mean, we've got Cook Inlet gas, and that's it. And, you know, we don't have those numbers. However, what we heard continuously from everybody was that to get something that works, people have to know what have some certainty. I'm not just talking about a fixed tax rate, but at least knowing what the tax rate is. And, you know, I think in other committees, the testimony has been that some of the players that we thought would be, or we anticipate being most at the table as pipeline companies, aren't going to be proceeding unless they have some confidence that they have a source of gas. And the unsurety of having a tax rate, or having the tax rate, well, we'll tell you the day before, may not get us there. So I'm just not sure that that this isn't one of the components that we really need to look at. I'm not saying it's going to be different than where it is right now, because, you know, the analysis that I've seen is, you know, profit tax is going to be high because there's very few expenses. I mean, let's face it, the development costs of Prudhoe Bay have already been there. The wells are there, the gas is coming out. In fact, they've got expenses pushing them back in the ground. So if we compare the known reserves and what it's going to cost to pull those out versus going out and developing, finding, risking exploration and all on a new oil field, I mean, I think the economics is going to be that the gas is more profitable per expense. So But the certainty of knowing what that tax rate would be might be much more important to getting successful applications through AGIA than, you know, sitting back and deciding we'll do AGIA and see if we get some applications, and then if not, we'll then come back together and try and work on the upstream.
Representative Seaton, I guess, again, two responses to that. The first one has to do with the characterization that some of the participants, as you characterized it, have expressed a reluctance to participate unless they had assurance that they would get the gas if they participated. I think that the testimony that we heard was a reflection of I believe what you're referring to is we had TransCanada come in and say that they would want to see more in order to go from an unsuccessful open season to a FERC certificate, and that they at this point weren't sure if they would participate given the fact that the state was requiring them to commit to go to a certificate, and that they were not comfortable with that. That's a different answer than saying that they weren't going to submit an application unless they knew that they were going to get the gas. It's a gradation on that. And what we recognize is that ultimately we need to have a vehicle that is shown to be economic and provides the lessees with a reason to put their gas into the line. And the question for all of us, and you know, a slide later on down the line that we'll get to, talks about when that decision has to be made by the producers. And what you have moved from a question of whether the producers need to have this level of certainty that they keep talking about at the time that they submit the application, or whether it's at the time that they are being asked to commit their gas. What we have structured in the bill is that level of certainty we believe is appropriate at the time that they commit their gas. And as part of that discussion, we can have that discussion as well in terms of whether that's really necessary or not. Frankly, our other team is right now talking about that particular issue very directly, the issue of the 10-year tax freeze is the hot topic of that particular hearing today. And what we're making clear is that when you look at the economics of from the lessee's perspective, from a Prudhoe Bay lessee's perspective, the economics are so positive when you factor in a $6 gas, you look at potentially a 50% rate of return for the reasons that you already identified in terms of the limited level of investment that's needed to get that gas flowing. And the question becomes, what level of tax change would be needed in order to affect that decision? And when you look at the history of Alaska and you realize, I mean, people talk about how the PPT change was so dramatic and so potentially seen as excessive or creating a sense of uncertainty. When you look at the history of Alaska's taxing take, we've never gone anywhere close to or above international norms. And to say that we need to provide them with certainty as to it, for me personally, I just take offense to that. We're trying to be responsive by giving them the 10-year window to get them to commit their gas to the line. Whether or not we need to expand that to a longer period of time in order to provide them with something to even begin the application process is a different discussion as well.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you on that point as well. The way I see this process happening out, you know, we're doing this in this room, the producers are participating, but their major role is to blow smoke, is to obscure the issue. So my question is, how does, you know, the way I see this is an equation being worked out. You know, and at various times you need numbers to plug in. Is this an appropriate time for those numbers that they're saying that they need, or do you can you compare them on a world market to other projects when they need certainty? When they, you know, when they're advancing to a project like this, at what time do they need specific things? Are they even close to needing a number like that at this point?
Well, clearly you'd get a different answer from them than you probably expect to get from us.
But when you look at comparable projects around the world, you can see when those things happen. Have you done that analysis?
Well, sure, but what breaks down is that you don't find any other jurisdiction that offers any kind of certainty along the lines that they're asking for. So you don't have a comparable to say when is this necessary along this timeline, because you don't have an example where that actually was ever provided.
Thank you.
So, but that's not saying that it's not something that should be in the bill. What we're trying to provide is a opportunity for participants to make decisions on how and when they're going to participate in this process. When we talk about certainty, it's really a response to the flip side, which is uncertainty. Where is the uncertainty with this project? And one of the discussions that we'll have is talking about how, from resource development company standpoint, you deal with uncertainties every day. There's uncertainties on price. There's uncertainties on your ability to produce. There's uncertainties on how you're going to transport it. And there's uncertainties with regard to the fiscal regime of the jurisdictions that you're operating within. The question that we have before us is, to what extent, before a number of these other uncertainties are worked out, uncertainties with regard to the tariff, for example, on the pipe, does Alaska need to lock in the uncertainties that are perceived on the state fiscal system? And when we look at that equation, as it were, and we look at the range of potential economics on the pipeline itself, and where you can expect, given relative, the cost of the pipeline and so on and so forth, we feel that once that has been defined and demonstrated and provided through an open season, and if necessary, locked down even further through getting that certificate, that these issues associated with the need for more certainty on the state fiscal system will fall away. They will no longer be the driving issue of the discussion. And that's the point of AGEA. Let's move past this point now where all these uncertainties exist and move to where there's knowns on a number of these issues so that we're not chasing ghosts. And the issue raised by Representative Seaton is a legitimate one in terms of, to what extent do we need to, and to what extent can we, provide a sense of what the gas production tax rate's going to be at the time we're asking people to submit applications. And I think it's a legitimate question to hear from industry on. Do they feel that it needs to be established before then, or is that going to be a driver for their decision? We haven't heard from them in terms of them saying, oh, we need to know before then, before we'll know whether to submit an application or not. Clearly, from our perspective, since the action that we're clearly trying to induce with that tax lock-in is that commitment of gas to the project, they need to know at that time what that rate's going to be so they can evaluate the value of that inducement. If the tax rate is favorable, then they're going to want to take advantage of that inducement. If it's not, then they're not going to see any value in locking it in because they're going to be using their political influence to try to drive it down later. So our feeling today is what we do know, is that we don't need to lock in the tax rate in AGIA. We can have the discussion at a subsequent time in terms of when it needs to be locked in, but we need to get this bill passed and we need to get this process going.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we talked about the tax bringing people to the open season, but part of AGIA is getting people to bid on the pipeline. Last I heard, the producers were interested with some stipulation in building the pipeline. So we not only have to be concerned about getting their gas to the open season, as an inducement, I think that if we, I don't know this, we'll ask this question of them, and that will be for them to answer, but this should be a fairly simple question. From a AGIA standpoint, if we lock in taxes and it brings more people to the table, what's wrong with that?
Nothing. We agree. If they answer the question as you suggested and they say that they need to know what the tax rate is for that period, that 10-year period, before they would consider submitting an application, clearly we have very consciously tried to design AGIA so that the producers can participate, will decide to participate. And if that's one of the drivers, then we need to address that.
And so if we lock in taxes now and it brings people to the table, it will not affect AGIA or anything. The bill as it stands, if we add a section that does that, that's not going to have any effects on other parts of the bill. And if, in fact, it does bring more people to the table, then it, in fact, is an inducement and should be an AGIA.
But Representative Johnson, through the chair, the question of locking in the tax rate in AGIA is more a question of what's the tax rate that you're willing to lock in. What my previously long-winded answer with regard to our level of confidence in the current tax rate is relatively low, to be honest. And I would be uncomfortable saying that the state should lock in the current tax rate for that period of time. And I don't think that you'd hear from, I mean, what you hear from the producers is they feel it's too high. And so I don't think they would see that as much of an inducement to lock in that rate. So the question becomes, are we going to just somewhat arbitrarily just pick a number, give it a lower number and lock that in? And we wouldn't support that just because it would not be an appropriate response to such a critical issue.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, it seems to me, just from the debate that we had previously in last year, that the producers have, it takes them so long to make decisions because they have to have people. I mean, it's not because they're not, their headquarters isn't in Alaska, most of them. And so they have to hear what we have to say and then go somewhere else and have meetings and it, all that kind of stuff takes a lot of time. And so it seems to me like they would need to have some certainty as soon as possible, because all they talk about is money and all that type of thing, and so I would think that they would need to know what they're dealing with before they even think whether they're even going to try anything.
Representative Wilson, I don't think anybody is suggesting that the rate be set weeks before they're asked to make a decision. The question isn't necessarily, do they need a month, do they need 3 months? It's more just a matter of, in the sequence of events, when does it need to fall? And there's going to be potentially a period of time of up to 3 years between when the application, the license is issued, and when the open season would take place. And so it's more a matter of when in the sequence does that need to be set, as opposed to how much time do they need to have to internally digest the information.
Okay.
So
what page are we on now? I'm sorry.
No.
One.
I'm pretty sure we're off the page.
The third slide with information on it.
Thank you.
We talk about the state terms, that we need to provide inducements in order to have a pipeline that's on the state's terms. And another shorthand version of this is the must-haves. What are the must-haves in the bill? And these are in the bill, in the section dealing with the requirements placed on the licensee. They talk about what the proposal needs to include in order to be considered a qualified proposal to be evaluated for consideration under the license. And the must-haves that we have in the bill are geared towards a vision of the North Slope's future that will have a vibrant, competitive oil and gas industry that will be continually exploring new areas and expanding the production on both oil and gas on the North Slope for decades to come. And in order to have that, we need to have two primary things. We need to have a pipeline that starts off with a low tariff and a pipeline that can be and will be expanded when new gas is found. And that expansion needs to be something that the explorers can rely upon. They can have a predictable time frame for when it will take place once they discover their gas, and they can expect the terms for shipping their gas to be reasonable. And so when we place these things in that must-have list, it was done with a tremendous amount of thought, of tremendous amount of research into what is commercially reasonable, and also a tremendous amount of consideration of where the state's true interests lie in this pipeline. And in addition to this vision of this vibrant North Slope, we also want to ensure that if we do have a gas line, that there'll be opportunities for in-state use, and that those be under, again, reasonably commercial terms, and that there's opportunities for Alaskans to enjoy the jobs that are going to be created by both the pipeline itself and by this expanding oil and gas sector in the North Slope region. So all of these things are contained in the section of the bill dealing with the must-haves. And from those are basically the state's bottom line. I mean, when we talk about this not being a negotiation, it's not a negotiation in the sense that we're sitting at the table going back and forth, but it is a negotiation in the sense that this is an offer that the state is making. And this is the bottom line offer that we're saying. Because we're not just telling one party, hey, this is the least we're going to expect. We're saying to a competitive field, if you want to participate, you have to at least give us this, and then you give us something more in order to make your project look better than the next guy. And there'd been discussion and suggestions that some of the things, or maybe all the things that are in this must-have list should be removed and moved over to the valuation criteria. Just let everybody compete. No bottom line, state doesn't require anything, and everybody just compete. And it's important from our perspective, one of the fundamental principles of AGEA, and the reason why we're here talking to you guys about a bill in the first place, is because we think it's critical for the state through this process to tell both the industry and the nation and whoever else is following along what our must-haves are. We need to speak in one voice and say, this is our bottom line. If we're going to get a pipeline, this is what we expect to get for it. And secondly, if we're going to put something of significant value on the table, $500 million is a whole lot of money, that we should get something in return. and we should get a pipeline that meets our needs.
Is there an objection to the must-haves that you're hearing from producers that say, get rid of those things, or they feel comfortable saying, you know, there's a limited number of people that can produce the must-haves, and then we can move away from the must-haves with a limited number of bidders and say, here's the deal?
There's a slight variation in the message from the producers. You had some Exxon in particular who spoke to the state shouldn't establish must-haves. The state should just have broad objectives and allow the applicants to suggest what the must-haves should be, and that the state would just evaluate that and then basically proceed. It was a Stranded Gas Act model. Other participants, whether they be the producers, the pipeline companies, or others, have suggested moving some of the items from the must-have list into evaluation criteria.
Right.
And I think what any time that that's suggested, you have to think about, you know, why is that? Is that because having it in the must-haves will potentially limit participation? And if that's the case, then you do have to weigh, is this really a must-have? Would we be willing to accept a project that didn't have this particular aspect if they met other things? And we feel that what we include in this list are truly the things that we feel we must have, and that shouldn't be negotiated away. The other aspect of it, when you hear that from participants, you have to ask, are they trying to change the competitive field that we're creating here so that it favors their interests and they have a competitive advantage? And that's another area of concern that we have. When you start moving these must-haves around, it's changing which projects are going to end up being favored. So both of those things are concerns for us when we review a proposal to change the nature of this. A GIA wouldn't be a GIA without the must-have list.
Okay. Representative Roses has a question.
I don't want to belabor the point, but you know, I sit here listening and trying to think through all of this and hearing the questions that are being asked and the responses to the question. From what I understand, one of the primary goals in the application process is that they have to have tell you what their project is. It has to include a route. It has to include size, course of design, timelines, a budget. What are you going to do for cost overruns? What's the capacity going to be? So the question I have is, how can you develop a comprehensive plan on what the capacity is going to be if you haven't had the discussions with the people that have the gas and how much they're willing to provide? And an integral part of how much they're willing to provide is probably directly proportional to the amount of tax they may have to pay and whether or not it's profitable for them to therefore distribute and be willing to say, yes, we're going to provide this much gas to the line. So, I mean, how do you put this plan together without having that commitment from the producers? And if the state has a set of must-haves, I can assure you that every other company that's out there that has to generate a profit also has a list of must-haves. And if their must-haves bump up against our must-haves, we're stalemate. And so somewhere along the line, there needs to be adjustments along the way. But I don't know, how does a person get to a point in the application process of providing you with a somewhat realistic expectation of capacity if they don't therefore have some sort of understanding of commitment from the producers as to what they're willing to provide, unless you're out there drilling your own gas wells? And how are those producers going to therefore provide you that answer if they don't know what their costs are going to be? And so I'm still in a quandary as to how we get there. I understand what you're saying. We don't want to address the fixed price in AGEA. This is the vehicle by how we're going to get to this mechanism. But somewhere before somebody submits this application and there's the three-year open season to get the producers to commit, if you're waiting for 3 years for them to commit, how do you build the capacity to begin with? That's the part I'm having a hard time understanding.
Representative Roses, through the chair. I think I'll have Don Scheffler talk to this because he has more experience with other pipelines. But the sequence of events is that they're going to provide us with a plan for a pipeline that has a certain capacity. That capacity is going to be based upon an expectation of what will be committed once they have an open season. It's the way any other pipeline, they're going to have to, they have to make a initial assessment of the project and what capacity may be desired and build their open season structure around that. And the open season will confirm or not what whether that's a reasonable expectation. But
let me stop you there, because then it'll So if I'm going to do an application and I've had some preliminary conversation with producers and they tell me, yes, we'll give you X trillion cubic feet of gas over X amount of time, and I say, okay, well, I need a pipe this size. And then I go out and have an open season. Now I know what the tax rate's going to be, and they say, whoop, wait a minute, we didn't know that. So now we can't, we're going to give you less than that, or we're going to give you way more than that in order to offset. Now you've designed it based on what you thought you were going to have as opposed to what you realistically would have. So I understand there's the, okay, how do we, part of your design has to be how can you expand the capacity? Well, do we want to expand the capacity because we're going to have new exploration, or are we going to want to expand the capacity because we underestimated what they were going to sell us because they didn't know what their fixed costs were?
I think actually I'll have Don come up and speak to this, because what it sounds like there's a little bit of confusion with regard to how the different aspects of
was that a follow-up
of the uncertainties fit into the level of gas that would be committed, because the tax rate, you know, if the tax rate changes, they don't suddenly have more gas to flow, and so that's not going to suddenly change the amount of gas that's committed to the line. But let me have Don, just if you want to just walk through. I'm not sure if we're getting ahead of one of the slides in here, but talk through how a pipeline company does that initial design, how the open season fits into it, and the variables associated with the amount of capacity that's
okay.
Bought.
For the record, I'm Don Shepler. I'm a lawyer in Washington, D.C. with the law firm of Greenberg Troy. In the lower 48, the open season process sort of evolved in the 80s and 90s as a way of the FERC being able to assure itself that pipeline capacity and new projects and new expansions was offered up to anybody that wanted access to it. It wasn't just a good old boy closed process. The way it honestly works is it's more or less it's an iterative process, or can be thought of as an iterative process. It does involve communication with the potential shippers. It involves having perhaps non-binding open seasons to test the water, so to speak. See who would bid and what they would be willing to bid in a process. And it is not unheard of for a pipeline to have put out an open season and determined that the demand was inadequate for them to build the project they had in mind. They've gone back to the drawing board. They've come up with a bigger project or a smaller project. In one instance that I'm aware of, there were at least four open seasons for a project, which ultimately resulted in a major pipeline interconnecting system. So, in answer to your question, Representative Roses, it is, as I say, it can be thought of as an iterative process. The parties definitely need to be talking to each other. And another aspect that needs to be factored in here is that the FERC is going to look at this open season proposal before it ever becomes live and official, again, to ensure that it's not a discriminatory open season. I hope that somewhat answered your question.
Well, if I may follow up, let me then. Okay, let me make sure I understood what you said. Somebody comes in with a design. They propose a certain size with a certain capacity. they have an open season, and then based on the results of that open season and the commitment that producers would make to providing gas for that line, they then would resize it based on the need.
Through the chair, generally, yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And in that context, it's important to note that the pipeline company is talking to its future customers, the shippers, which can be producers or non-producers, and there's a dialogue going on. Here in Alaska, certainly for the most part, there is a known quantity, at least a known size of what is the resource base that is on the North Slope. So it's like it's that big and perhaps bigger. So it's you don't have the question that you would have in the Rocky Mountains, for example, of how much gas is really out there, how much is gas is going to come onto my pipeline, how much gas is going to go on to somebody else's pipeline.
Right. Well, I understand that. Then let me ask a question a little bit differently. Because I know what the open season is. I mean, I understand that concept. Is they come in and say we will provide this much, and the commitment is they're going to pay for that amount whether they actually deliver it or not. I mean, I understand how all that works. But the question I would have would be, if we're having an application, they're having some preliminary discussions. Not all the prices are fixed. The taxation hasn't been fixed yet, and so you know they're sort of, you know, hedging themselves against what all these cost factors are going to be. Are we required to have the application process prior to the open season, or would it make sense to have the open season and then design a pipe the first time to fit the capacity that's guaranteed? I mean, why would we want to have a second, third, and fourth open season in order to get the size of the pipe right? Well, wouldn't we figure out what our capacity is and then design the pipe around the capacity?
Well, again, Representative Roses, as I say, the unique situation in Alaska is that you know that there's 8 billion cubic feet more or less that's going around in circles up there now, and ultimately that's going to have to be drawn off the field. We also have the experience of the negotiations a year or 2 years ago where companies came in under the Stranded Gas Act and made proposals, which very much centered around one reasonably narrow range of sizes. The real issue, I think, is will the producers commit their gas to a project in the open season?
Correct.
And if you think about it, you've got the process of the open season, which starts the FERC proceeding, the FERC processes. That leads to eventually a FERC certificate application, leading to a FERC certificate. You can think of that as more like a funnel in terms of narrowing the levels of uncertainties as they get closer. And you talked about how they would have their various price outs and whatnot at the open season level. You can think of the whole process as narrowing down to where the level of uncertainty, by the time the FERC has approved a certificate, you know the size of the pipe that's been approved, you know the route that it's going, you know the projected cost, you don't know the actual cost. All of those things are less known the further in advance that you are in the process. So the open season just starts that process going and culminates in under the AGIA with the commitment by the ultimate licensee or the applicant to process a FERC certificate, all of which narrows the uncertainty down.
And if I may follow up, and I appreciate that, I understand that. But what I see happening with this is we have a funnel that keeps going like this instead of like this. Because you have an application process where there are some theoretical concepts that are made in terms of the design. We have an open season. If the open season exceeds the expectation, then it goes like this because we need a bigger pipe, and then you got to start zeroing in where you're going. What I'm asking is, as opposed to sort of put it in terms of building a house, if I design a house and I know what I want to do in the house and then I go to the bank and try to borrow the money to get the house, If they say, no, I'm sorry, we won't give you that much, then it's very easy for me to decide how much of this I have to reduce. But what I see happening in this particular scenario is we're designing this concept, this pipe. We're going to base our decision on who we're going to grant the license to based on the design of a pipe, based on a route, based on capacity, based on all the factors that I've outlined here. Then we're going to go to an open season. After we've selected an applicant, after we've decided to give somebody a license, and now all of the design work they did before gets modified based on what happens in the open season. Is there a law preventing an open season occurring before you design the size of the pipe and before you give somebody a license to move forward with the pipe? Because then you're not buying a pig in a poke. You've got a commitment from somebody saying, yes, we're going to give you X amount of gas. Yes, we'll commit to this many years. And yet you know what your volume capacity is. Now there's a commitment to it. You make one design, you do it right the first time instead of having to modify it four or five times based on one, two, three, four, five open seasons.
Representative Roses through the chair. You have crystallized the exact problem that we find ourselves in.
Okay.
The problem that we find ourselves in is that the natural progression that you would expect this project to advance in is just what you described. Mm-hmm. But it's not happening. And the reason why it's not happening is that we don't have an efficient market, that the market's not working in that direction. And the reason is we've got three companies that hold the rights to all the gas, and they're not willing to move ahead with any decision making until they get something. I mean, we know generally it's something more than what they got last year, because
stop you right there for clarification. So by doing a GIA and now having somebody apply with a theoretical construct for a pipe, they now have more than they had before?
What they have is they have a project that actually defines the economics of the line. And they will make their analysis and they will make their decision based upon a known pipe and a known cost, and they will explain to the rest of us being the owners of the gas, why they are not putting their gas, why they're not committing their gas to the line based upon a real project. Right now, we're not having that discussion in the context of what is the actual economics to them in their obligations under our leases to sell their gas. And so what AGIA is intended to do is to force the issue. And we're forcing the issue through the state putting the money up to get somebody. And it could be a third-party pipeline company to accept the state's participation and to move the project to the open season in order to put the issue on the table for everybody to see. Here's a project. Here's how much it's going to cost. Here's how much the tariff's going to be. Here's how much risk the producers are going to have to take. And then the producers are going to have to make a decision on whether or not they're going to do it. Now,
let me ask you a question at that point. That's perfect. Because right now you're saying the way that I characterized it was the ideal way that we would like to do it, but we're not getting participation, right. So therefore we can't. So we have to construct a different method by which to try to get them to the table. So now we come up with this concept of a pipeline through AGIA. We have a licensee there. We have a proposed pipeline. We now have an open season. So what happens if those same three producers that are not willing to cooperate now don't cooperate then? How are we any different then than we are now, except potentially part of the $500 million less in our bank?
Because then we will have a project that has an economic base, and we can ask the producers, okay, given the cost of this project, given the level of tariff that is, you know, this is the range of the tariff, this is what you're exposed to. And when we project that to your leases on the North Slope, why are you not putting your gas into the line?
And my answer is because I don't want to, there's not enough profit. Now
and we say, okay, well, explain that to Congress, explain that to the consumer, explain that to us, given that we have leases that obligate you to do this, explain that to Federal Trade Commission that says that, that you have to engage in competitive, a competitive market. I mean, they'll have a lot to answer to if the project proves to be economic and they choose not to do it. And that's really what it comes down to, is we're moving the process ahead so that we all know better what actually is at issue. Because right now, it's a whole lot of uncertainty and a whole lot of smoke, and we just don't know.
And I guess unless, I'm going to go back to sort of what Representative Seaton was asking earlier, unless those producers see something different before them that's going to entice them to now sell what they're not willing to commit to now, you say, well, we have data and support to now go to all these other agencies and say, see, we create an opportunity they're unwilling to sell. Sounds to me like we're back to the stranded gas situation that we just got through, except we're farther down the road and we've wasted more time and we go through court and all the litigation and we're, you know, 15, 20 years down the road and we're bankrupt by then. So,
well,
I mean,
we're both concerned about the same thing.
Right.
We're both concerned about the risk that as time progresses, Alaska becomes more and more teetering on a financial edge. And the question for all of us is, do we want to have a discussion about what is necessary in order to make this project happen today with all these uncertainties and the ability of basically any party to say, well, we don't know about this, so you're going to have to tighten down this aspect. You're going to have to provide us more value there. Or do we want to have the project move ahead to where we all know what it is? We all know what the project is going to cost. It's not this number that everybody keeps throwing around. Is it 40? Is it 80? Is it 20? We'll actually have a number that a company will say, this is the number and this is what we're going to go forward with. This is how we're going to deal with cost overruns. This is how much it's going to ultimately cost to ship your gas. When we have the discussion in that context, it becomes a completely different discussion than what we're having right now. And what AGEA provides is it provides a couple different things, and we can jump to that slide if you want, but it provides an opportunity for the producers to decide now that, hey, we want to control this process. We want to control the costs on the pipeline. We want to control, you know, how this project moves ahead. We don't want to have a third-party pipeline company come forward with a proposal that then we have to commit our gas to, and so we will participate in AGEA and take the state's terms in order to
guarantee
to make sure that, that we don't lose that opportunity. And they can choose not to. They can choose, well, actually, we're going to let it ride. We're going to let somebody else move the project ahead. And then they get another opportunity to make a decision. But at each step of the way, they have an opportunity to decide whether to participate. And that is, from our vantage point, a much better position for the state to be in terms of having that discussion framed around an actual project than where we are now, where we know that we gave up a whole lot a year ago, and in exchange, we didn't even get a commitment to move the project ahead. So we don't know what that cost ultimately is going to be. But we do know that as we move forward, we become more desperate than they do. And so we need to change this discussion so that it ends up being around a project that we can hold up and say, hey, look, this looks, you know, explain to us why you wouldn't commit to this project. And or that they recognize, hey, we don't want to be, they don't want to be in that situation. They don't want to have to. And so they say, okay, we'll go forward with it. But either way, we need to change the situation that we find ourselves in.
I'll go to you right next. I just wanted to make a point on this. The producers are not without risk. At this moment, it's not their gas. They only have a lease to produce it. But there's no pipe and there's no plan. They have nothing that they are required to do. In a few years, if you have a plan and a builder, now they're at risk, because if they say we're still not interested, they have a requirement. And if they don't meet the requirement, they give up the gas. And so if they're willing to take the risk 3 years from now to give up their gas and wind up with nothing and explain that to a shareholder, as opposed to an advantage of right now saying, listen, I don't like this situation, but we want to be the builder. They've told us that on how many times they want to be the builder. It's an opportunity to be the builder, because if you don't take the opportunity now, you lose the opportunity and you still have to give up the gas. So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two points that I'm concerned about. On page 4 of the bill, this is the requirements that you want in the application, and C and D under 1 or under 2, C and D says that the state wants an economic and technical viability of the project, so something the analysis, and also D is the economically and technically viable plan. Well, when we're talking economics, from my just memory that I'm pulling back from last year, we were told at that time that they could not make a decision on the size of the pipe until after the open season. And then FERC would get involved, but because of that, they were even thinking about a 48-inch pipe, which is, I think, is the biggest that we've anywhere there's ever been. And if they would go to a 52-inch pipe, which would be cheaper in the long run because of the amount of gas, because as more gas is found, it was cheaper to have the big pipe than to have feeder lines. So in the long run. However, a 52-inch pipe has never been invented yet, and the trucks and the machinery to put it into the ground haven't been invented yet. And so I just can't figure out how they're going to say this is an economically viable project when they don't even, when things haven't been invented yet.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, an excellent point with regard to why we're analyzing these projects based upon both what they're proposing to provide in terms of value and also likelihood of success. And it gets down to that point. If we have a proposal that comes in that is based upon new technology, that either a strength or a size of pipe that doesn't exist now, that's based upon steel that is currently in the lab but not in the ground, then we have to seriously question whether or not they're going to be able to deliver that. And that's why the analysis they're providing is both economic and technical. But in part of what, and this goes back to a concern that Representative Rose's, is they're going to make a proposal to us. And they're going to base it upon the known resource and an expectation about what may be committed at an open season. And they're going to design the pipe based upon that range of possible commitment that they're going to receive. And when we do our own analysis, we're going to have to factor in the likelihood of actually getting that level of commitment and what is the flexibility of their plan to various levels of commitment that they may receive, and what's the outcome of that. And in the end, you know, we have to recognize that what they propose to us now is before an open season, before they get the actual commitments, before they have a sense of what that initial shipping capacity is going to be. But they're also going to have to be responsive to our interests and their interests in having a line that is also expandable and also would be cost effective for some foreseeable time beyond that. So when they provide us with their proposal, it's going to have to be responsive both at that initial construction phase. If they're going to provide us with, you know, we're going to get to this particular point, we're going to have an open season, and if we get this level of commitment, then we're going to do this. If we get this level of commitment, we're going to do this. If we get this level of commitment, we're going to do that. And those different scenarios are going to both be reflective of what their design is going to be of the pipe or what other steps they're going to take in order to either get more gas committed or just pursue a particular capacity on through to the next gate in the process. But that's why we have both economic and technical viability of the project, but also the whole work plan, because it's all going to factor together.
I guess I'm just a little bit confused how they are. So in other words, you're asking for them to put down on paper imaginary numbers and stuff that they think will work out because they don't have the real numbers, and then you have to look at these imaginary numbers and decide if those imaginary numbers are possible.
I'd say that they're not. All of the numbers that they give us are going to be based upon the level of analysis that they have done thus far. And the level of confidence that we will have in their numbers will be based upon the level of detail that they provide us in terms of the analysis that they've already done. And so when you talk about imaginary numbers, they're going to have something that backs it up. I mean, it's possible that somebody may come in and just, you know, at their computer one day just decide to type up and make up a bunch of numbers, but that's not going to get them a license. There's going to have to be some preliminary work that goes into sizing costs and so forth based upon the understanding of the market, understanding of how gas lines are built, and they're going to provide that information to us, and we're going to make a determination of how much confidence we should have in those numbers. Are they completely imaginary, or are they based upon real work? And that will be a driving factor. That's part of our evaluation criteria.
So what you really kind of want from them is like, okay, if we get this much commitment in the open season, we will have this size of pipeline, and this is what we think it'll cost. But if we only get this much commitment, then we'll have this size pipeline, and this is how it will factor out. So you're really asking for more.
Well,
than
they
one?
Will. They will decide how they want to approach that issue themselves. If they are going to make that kind of a distinction in their proposal, or not, and that's part of. Again, you know, there's a certain amount of flexibility in terms of what they can choose to do at a particular gate in the process. If they have an open season that results in a certain amount of commitment, then they could choose to redesign the pipe and move forward. Or they could choose to have a subsequent open season with some additional step that will make it more likely to get gas committed. We don't know. And that's part of what we're offering them the opportunity to provide us. Do you want to add anything to that?
Representative Johnson here has another question.
Thank you. I want to also deal with the must-haves and maybe a little higher view. And I kind of want to start with one that says there are five takeoff points. What are they? Where are they?
We're not stating about the applicant's not going to state them. They just have to commit that they will agree to five once the demand is there to require them.
Okay, and if this committee, if I recommended an amendment right now and we voted on it and said there should be two, I mean, it's in your must-haves and you must have it. Is the governor going to veto this bill?
We've testified before that there's no magic to five.
I'm not trying to get at five. I just picked that as kind of an absurd example. If we go to three, well, then if it's not five, then it's not a must-have. I guess that maybe I'll jump ahead. So if it's not a must-have, why is it a must-have?
The must-have is that they have to agree to meet in-state demand, and we believe that one aspect of that is having a commitment that they will provide for 5 offtake points. Now,
and I want to go back to my question. Where are they? Why 5? Why not 7? Why not 3? What's the magic? Certainly, we've told people that they need, they're going to be doing all this, these numbers, and we're going to have to come to us with certain certainty that we're going to evaluate. Why can they not expect the same from us? And if we say 5, there's some thought gone into it.
Representative Johnson, the issue with regard to whether 5 offtake points should be in the must-haves goes twofold. One is, if we take it out, is it still as valuable to the state? And the answer, from our perspective, is no. We need to have that in there.
The numbers are not important.
Well, the question is, would we, from my perspective, the question would be, if they wanted to provide us with a proposal that didn't have offtake points, would that be a proposal that we should consider? And by having this in the requirements, what we're saying is, unless you're willing to commit to 5 offtake points, then we don't want to consider your application. Now, we're not requiring them in that application to name those 5 offtake points. We're not requiring them to commit to any specific offtake points. They just have to commit that when the opportunity comes and there is a demand for in-state use, that they will allow that offtake point to take place. That's part of their commitment to us. And whether we end up saying that they have to have 3, 5, or 7 is, I mean, we're open to the discussion. 5 just, from our purposes, met the possible range that we could anticipate within the state.
Okay. And I appreciate that. And I picked that because it's a kind of an absurd example. But I want to know what really is a must-have, because you just said 5 isn't really a must-have. It could be 7, as long as it supplies the state with gas. In this piece of legislation, there are 20-some-odd things that are quote-unquote must-haves. If this committee decides to take that to 18, do we not have a deal? I mean, are they must-haves to the extent that if we touch them as a committee, it's off the table? Are they must-haves? I guess I'm looking for, I really want to know what are deal breakers. And that's what I'm trying to get to. And I use the 5 takeoff points as kind of an absurd example. But I want to know what in this 20 are absolutely, positively deal breakers.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I guess the issue comes down to the term must-have. And let me just clarify what I mean by
exactly
that.
Right.
Is that we're not saying, by putting this slide up here saying the state must-haves focus on the future, we're not saying that these are the administration's must-haves in the bill, that without these things we're going to veto this bill. That's not the nature of the discussion. The reason why we're labeling them as must-haves is, within the context of the bill, this is what the state, when the bill's passed, this is what the state is telling the rest of the world are the state's must-haves. And when we talk about whether they should or should not be in here, then we're open to discuss what should or should not be on this list. But when you ask the question, is this an administration's must-have, that's a different issue. That's a different question.
Yeah, I understand. Just a follow-up. So there really not must-haves in the purest definitions of must-have? I mean, so why aren't they, why don't we set them as guidelines and use them as criteria? So, and this is what our measuring stick is. Everyone knows our measuring stick. The person that gets to these or exceeds these, that is the winner of the contract. And if somebody comes in with 3 takeoff points, but they meet everything else perfectly right, I mean, they're right on with everything else, why would they be excluded as non-compliant when they've got the best deal and we're really talking not really must-haves?
We believe that in order to provide an exchange that is envisioned in the bill. The state's willing to put up $500 million. We're willing to match them in their costs.
Coordinate.
That we should, we have a right to ask for things in return. And we believe that it's appropriate for the state to at least set a floor for what we expect in return and allow the other parties to compete on it. When we talk about five offtake points, we believe it's appropriate for the state to tell the applicant pool that five offtake points is a must-have, that if you don't include it, then your application won't be considered. That's a decision that we made in the context of all the others in there. And at the end of the day, we would prefer to have that remain in there as a requirement in order for an application to be considered. We don't consider it to be appropriate to leave it as a guideline or a request. We think it's appropriate for the state to say, if you want our money, if you want our participation, then you're gonna agree to this.
I think as part of that answer, the bill came to us from oil and gas with 20. Who knows that we won't pass it out of here with 23, and finance won't reduce it to 17, and a conference committee bring it right back to 20. We don't know. But we're just discussing the fact that the bill has five offtakes. Where they'll be, actually, do they even have to put them into construction? Maybe we'll tell them in the year 2020 that we want one offtake in Glen Allen or not. So I'm kind of guessing that the best answer to Representative Johnson's question is nothing is imperative to be in the bill, but well, that's what we're doing here, is reconstructing it or accepting what came over from the previous committee, and we'll move on to the next committee. And if we as a five people here want to make it 21 or 18, that's probably what will happen.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I sure. think that gets to the heart of it, because what I'm really looking at is what is imperative to the bill. What, and I'm just going to go back to the term deal killer. What's a deal killer? What do we have in this from an administration standpoint that is absolutely must have, non-negotiable, floor, can't do? And that's kind of what I'd like to get to, is what can, if there's anything, if there, because I want a lot of proposals. I'd love to have tons of them to build a pipeline. So what can we do to broaden it to, and what is going to be something that the administration says absolutely, or we as a body say absolutely, this is a deal breaker. And that's what I'd like to get to. And the five takeoff points, once again, is just, I picked it because it was just the one I looked at.
I guess, Representative Johnson, through the chair, it's a bit disconcerting to have a discussion about this bill in the context of what can be stripped out and have the bill still be something that the administration is willing to endorse. I mean, we believe the bill is in great shape right now. We don't think that it needs to be changed really much at all. As far as if there's something that needs to be changed, then let's talk about it. But I don't think that we're in a position to say, well, these, of the 20-something odd pages here, as long as you don't touch, there's 31 pages here. If you don't touch these 20, then you can play with the rest. I mean, that to me isn't the nature of a constructive discussion on the issue.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah, and so I think that we don't come to you saying that this is an untouchable product. We are very interested in hearing what areas concern you or what areas you think are problematic, and we can try to work it out. But we didn't come and basically put a bunch of fluff in here thinking, okay, this is the stuff we'll deal and this is the stuff we won't deal. That's just not the way we approached it.
Actually, I'm going to ask you to move on with the presentation, but not until I mention something that in 2000, the producers invested is it 100 million or something?
125 million.
125 million on a feasibility study. So there has been work already completed on, I'm guessing they're saying it's a 48-inch pipe, it's an inch and a quarter thick, it's Schedule 80, and it goes down the highway. Now let's expand from that if you have questions.
And TransCanada, I'm sure, will tell you how much they've invested in this project as well.
We don't have to talk about that. Well,
thanks, if you could just proceed with...
Sure, and I'll go through this really fast because I think a lot of this we've already covered. The decision-making process is intended to be transparent, competitive, again, not a negotiation off to the side. We have the opportunity to both review the bids, but review them in a public setting. I mean, they come in, the proposals come in, they're made available to the public. The public can comment on them, and then a decision's made. It comes back to the legislature for approval. The entire thing is intended to be as transparent as possible so the public can have confidence in the outcome. And just from a general structure, we feel that it is the appropriate decision-making structure for the government. I mean, as a representative of the people, this is the more appropriate method for dealing with an issue of this magnitude.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Just a question on the public process. When public's going to have, right now, I think it's 60 days. Is the administration's position that you're just going to put two or four, whatever number of contract proposals on the table without analysis for the public? Or is there going to be some process where there's going to be side-by-sides built up maybe even some of your weighted issues, how you're looking at them and how important they are to the public, so that they have the ability to look at them as the lay public and understand them?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, at this point, given the potential variety of applications, we don't have a preconceived idea of how the information will be presented, but clearly, in keeping with the intent of engaging the public in this discussion, it would be incumbent on us to make the information available in a way that is as understandable to the public as possible. So there will be effort put into the way that the information is provided to the public and what can be done to make it more easily understood. But in the bill itself, we don't have anything that doesn't exist. So next, we're going to move to a discussion in more detail of some of the areas that have got a lot of discussion. We're going to start with the expansion provisions, and for this, I'm going to turn it over to Don to just run through some of the issues associated with primarily the FERC's role in all this.
Again, for the record, I'm Don Shepler with Greenberg Troy. Expansion of the pipeline is vital to the goal, ultimately, of establishing a vibrant, competitive gas and oil-driven economy on the North Slope. In FERC's orders that have come out, they have recognized that Alaska is a unique situation. There will almost certainly be only one pipeline built out of Alaska. The FERC has said that uniqueness distinguishes it from what it has done in the lower 48 with respect to how expansion capacity is priced, and has led the FERC to adopt a rebuttable presumption in favor of rolled-in pricing, which is to say that as the costs are accumulated, they're simply divided over all of the volumes that are under contract. The FERC in their orders recognize that there were already some, call them governmental subsidies, that were baked into the initial project in the form of federal loan guarantees that will reduce the borrowing costs of the sponsor of the pipeline project, as well as the accelerated depreciation for 7-year depreciation for income tax purposes, which has the effect, when you go through the machinery of making rates, it reduces rates for initial shippers. And with the $500 million that the state is putting into the front end part of the process, the bottom line is that the rates for all initial shippers will be reduced by all of these factors, thus somewhat dampening or reducing the real world impact of rolling in pricing when expansion becomes more expensive. Initial expansions, as I'm sure you've been told, will typically be based on just adding new compressor stations or new compressor units, which are relatively low cost and produce substantial bang for the buck. But eventually, it's recognized that in order to maximize the value of the pipeline itself, you're going to come to the point in time, the fork in the road, where you're going to involve the expensive looping, and expansions are going to raise the rates for all shippers, the existing shippers as well as the expansion shippers that have come along.
Representative Guttenberg.
If I may, I understand what rolled in rates and the compression stations. Could you get into what the looping is?
Through the chair. I'm a lawyer, not an engineer, but with that caveat, which I'll bail out real quick if you ask, very much more here on that. But basically, looping is the pipeline industry term for putting in another pipe, a parallel pipe, that's basically a welded in, integrated piece of the original pipe. It involves, once you've compressed the gas and there's no more expansion that can come from compression, you can basically double the size of the pipe by putting in another run of pipe. That's what's called looping. And as you might expect, that is expensive because you're buying miles of pipe.
If you only put it in for 10 miles out of the 2,000,
My understanding is it's dependent. I mean, you put it in a few miles, I believe, downstream of a compressor initially, and then as more volumes come on, then you would put it in a few more miles downstream of that compressor, and until ultimately, I mean, the ultimate build out would be, a dual line in effect. But obviously, that is more expensive than simply buying another compressor unit or putting in another compressor station. And at some point, when you start doing that, the rates, when you roll them in, go up. And one of the things that is baked into AGIA is the fact that the obligation for the pipeline company to file for and support rolled-in rates is capped. They are they would have to commit that they would file for and propose rolled-in rates so long as that did not increase the rate for existing shippers or even expansion shippers more than 15% above the, call it the day one rate, the starting point, the initial rate that was set when the pipeline went into service.
Let me interrupt you for a question from Representative Seaton.
And that 15% rolled in rate, is that nominal dollars? Is that, I mean, how does that dollars of the day it started? What's the
Representative Seaton through the chair? I'm a lawyer, again, not an economist, and nominal dollars get me out of my league. But the target here is a rate that was paid, say the initial recourse rate, the initial regulated rate that the FERC approved when the pipeline went into service. Whatever that approved maximum lawful rate would be, the AGIA contemplates that rate being increased by as much as up to 15% through roll-in, and that the pipeline company would have the obligation to file for that, subject again to FERC approval.
Okay, do a follow up?
Thank you. So I'm trying to figure out the significance of this. And let's say it's 10 years later, and we're talking about dollars that aren't, you know, we've had inflation and everything else. So is this really a meaningless number because it was $1.50 and now, you know, we had 10 years later of inflation and we're still talking about $1.50 plus 15 cents non-inflationary adjusted? Is that what we're really talking about, the actual dollar value at the time that they, the FERC set the rate?
Looks like we're going to turn this over.
We're adding a new voice to the mix. We're bringing in Kevin Banks.
Well, when I heard, for the record, my name is Kevin Banks. I'm the acting director of the Division of Oil and Gas. When I heard Mr. Scheffler say he wasn't an economist, I just couldn't remain sitting down because I am. So I think what I'm going to do is probably add to the cloud of in the fog of confusion, because that's usually what economists generally do. But the point I want to make is as Mr. Scheffler has said, if the initial rate is something like $2, and 10 years from now we're at a point where some expansion is going to occur that will raise the cost of shipping to something like $2.30 on a rolled in basis. What we're saying is that inflation is not taken into account in this situation. It's $2.30, even though the cost now, 10 years later, because of inflation, the cost of steel, the cost of other materials has gone up. The fact that you're basing it off of what it was at the initial open season works in the favor of that initial shipper, because the 15% uptake is still just measured against a $2.30 cap in how much the rolled-in rate. If the expansion is more than $2.30 in this little hypothetical example, which it could very well be because price of steel has gone up, inflation has occurred, why then the amount above that $2.30 will be determined using an incremental basis, and the cost will be shifted over to the new shippers. So to answer your question, I think the right answer is that it's nominal, and two, that it works to the favor of the initial shipper if there has been inflation that has occurred during this intervening period. And at the end of the day, it means then that the cap means is that any amount over this 150% of the initial rate will be borne, or 15% up over the initial rate, rather, will be borne by the expansion shippers.
Okay, and I'm going to ask that we kind of, if we can get back to AGEA, and I think we've wandered a little bit, but Representative Rose has had a question.
Actually, this isn't AGEA, the 15%, but let me then ask this question. What if then there was another roll in farther down the line? Is it still, because you've already hit the 15% cap, there's no new increase and everything would then be passed on to the new guy? Or does the $2.30 now become the initial for the next roll in?
The way we look at it, Senator, Representative Roses, through the chair, is that the $2.30 is what it is, and it will remain that way. So the next expansion will be incremental in that case.
Through the chair, just to clarify, it won't necessarily be incremental. What the way that the GIA is set up is we are obligating our licensee to support rolled in rates up to this limit. Beyond that, they're free to do whatever they want. And so they may propose rolled in rates for their own purposes. And we have included this with an understanding that the licensee may, for reasons most likely because they're primarily an initial shipper, would prefer not to roll in rates beyond this level. But what needs to be, I guess, recognized is that you don't, the way that we're proposing here doesn't say that you get rolled in rates up to the 15% and then it's automatically incremental. That's not the proposal here. It's just our licensee is obligated under the license to support rolled-in rates up to this, in the purpose of the example, when the rate becomes $2.30, Beyond that, they're free to do whatever they choose to do. And that's, as you said, that $2.30 is forever. It's the cap forever. So once you get above that because of inflation or because of the looping, then this falls out by the wayside. It doesn't become a relevant issue anymore.
Go ahead.
Follow up on that point. So then that becomes, this rate is the tariff that they're paying to ship gas down the line, correct?
Correct.
So the initial commitment by the producers to put X volume of gas into the line, they're going to start off with this initial rate. We now expand the line because somebody else has come in with a new field. They can be brought up to 15% more than what they originally paid, still based on the volume that they had agreed to pay.
They, at each expansion, when the rate changes, they will have the opportunity to opt out of their commitment. I mean, they have that opportunity when the expansion takes place, but they will, I mean, by...
Excuse, is that in the bill? Because I missed that.
Why don't you talk about how?
The opt-out part.
The opt-out part falls out of FERC policy. FERC requires that when you do an expansion as a pipeline company, you have to offer to let parties turn back capacity. So as it's just driven by environmental concerns, so you might not need an expansion at all if enough people that have the capacity are willing to give it back to the pipeline to sell to the guys that want the new capacity. So
let me take a theoretical. I'm one of the three producers. You finally twisted my arm enough with the noose hanging around my neck. I've agreed to sell it. 5 years from now, 5 years after we start have gas flowing down the line, we bring on another new well. So you go to the three original people and say, you can opt out now if you want because we've got this other gas coming in. What stops them from saying, fine, we don't want to sell it anymore? We're going to all opt out. Unless, of course, you renegotiate with us and we get a different tariff rate.
Could I?
What stops that from happening?
I want to interject something here. Just because we get expansion doesn't mean the price goes up. Remember, the price of a pipeline is so expensive, and the price of a compressor is almost nothing compared to the price of a pipeline, that the initial expansion probably lowers the price for everybody. Am I correct or not correct?
That's true.
So it's a bargain right up to, and I think it's called a J-curve. Initially, it drops down, and then it comes back up, and then somebody says looping, and it shoots up like a rocket. But there's a big period in there of expansion where everybody is more than happy. Somebody reduced the price. And so there's something in expansion that's beneficial. It isn't necessarily that you hit expansion, I'm out of here.
Well, I understand that, except that we're talking about the potential in the bill for a 15% increase. And that's what I'm talking about. I don't see anybody wanting to opt out if you lower their price.
Right.
But I do see somebody potentially wanting to opt out if you increase their price, because then it becomes a leverage point. And so I guess the concern I would have would be if you get to the point of where it is increasing their cost by the 12%, 15%, whatever, there is no mechanism or guarantee that all three of the major producers can't then say, okay, we're going to pull out unless you renegotiate.
The turnback is limited, Representative Rosas.
But
limited to the amount of the expansion?
Yes, the new demand. And I would point out that the FERC policy in the lower 48 from the 1960s up until 1999 was for rolled-in treatment for any and all expansions. It was in 1999 that their policy changed when they said, you know, this is creating an unlevel playing field for competing pipelines. You know, an incumbent pipeline may be able to offer service that's really not more efficient than a new coming pipeline. So the policy in the lower 48 switched over to incremental pricing. But again, since the 1960s, the FERC has essentially required that all pipeline expansions be rolled in even when it increased shippers' rates, existing shippers' rates. And in 1995, they said, well, we're going to limit that somewhat. We're going to say if the expansion has any system benefits at all to all users and increases shippers' rates by a little bit, they said 5% was their threshold, that they would require rolled-in pricing. So it is not a foreign concept in the lower 48 that an existing shipper find his rates going up as a result of expansions.
And
to go back to the chart, if we can kind of circle back here, rolled-in rates are the standard operating practice for expansions in Canada. And I think Kevin Banks can share with you some observations of what that has done in terms of opening the producing basins in Alberta, for example.
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman. The point being that rolled-in rates, Canada, at the outset of its oil and gas industry in Alberta, was much the same in a way as Alaska is today, where there was very long distances to cover to get to market. And rolled-in rates basically made it possible, at least initially, for the within Alberta, for the market to expand dramatically. And we see a very vibrant and dynamic oil and gas industry there that we could only hope to achieve here in Alaska. And at the same time, very long line pipelines were built across Canada to New York, Canada, from Alberta into the West Coast, and also to Chicago as a consequence of rolled-in rates. And furthermore, the development of the gas line system within Alberta has been enhanced by that. So now today you have thousands of producing fields and thousands of miles of pipelines serving those fields. And here again, it models what, as a consequence of that kind of development, you can look to Alberta and see the same kind of access to the marketplace that we see in the lower 48, where there's a fairly competitive market for transportation as a consequence of the kind of development that followed Canada's policies for setting rates.
Now,
I can carry on then, if you like. Resource risk has to do with what to exploration and production companies, and for that matter, the state have to look at in terms of their expectations going forward. And I'll read for you a quote from Rex Tillerson at Exxon. Published last month. We're willing to take geological risk, we're willing to take cost risk, we're willing to take price risk. I think some of you have read this. But we can't take fiscal terms changing on us risk, because then I can't calculate the basis on which to decide whether it's a good investment or not. And I would like to talk about how the state is also similarly involved in each of those kinds of risk. As to the geological risk, I think you can recognize that the state has its own geography, its own geology here to deal with, just as our lessees do. We are now more involved than ever in the cost of developing those risks, because we've assumed a net profit tax system through the PPT. We share in the transportation cost risk. Companies will be allowed to deduct whatever they're paying for transportation, including the potential that they may have to pay for a take-or-pay situation. In our leases and in the kind of arrangements that we're proposing to make with the producers under the AGEA, we would certainly assume that their actual and reasonable costs, including empty capacity, if that should occur, should be an allowable deduction on their royalties and taxes. Price risk. Obviously, we're going to assume the same kind of market risk and evaluate our royalties and taxes on the basis of whatever prices the market will deliver at any given time in the future. But we also face a few other kinds of risks that we can't mitigate. We have the risk of non-performance by our lessees. We don't control the timing of production from our leases. That is ultimately a decision that is made by the lessee as they work through their own economics. And furthermore, I suppose Point Thompson is an example of where perhaps that becomes an extreme example of how we don't have real control over, except by fairly draconian measures to induce production on our leases. We're furthermore, in spite of the fact that the oil and gas business is just generally risky, and it is a business in which large corporations participate in it every day, the reason they can manage the risk is because they have a portfolio of activities all around the world. I mean, the oil and gas business is an integrated industry for a lot of reasons, and primarily it's because it's a way of managing risk, managing price risk, managing risk of geology by having the opportunity to develop high risk, high reward prospects balanced against low risk, low reward prospects. The state doesn't have that kind of broad portfolio, obviously. We're stuck with what we have. We don't have the opportunity to collect royalties on our properties in Kazakhstan, for example. And so, in a sense, we're faced with a risk a profile that is different. We may be aligned in many other settings, but we're not necessarily aligned on that. I think I'd like to make just a few comments about price risk. Price risk movements, and we are told, have just recently have gone from $4 to $14 for the price of gas in the lower 48. And that's quite a swing in prices. And I'm here to tell you that that's a much greater swing than we could ever possibly believe we could impose in terms of changing our fiscal terms. While I recognize that it is an issue that that our lessees have raised, they're used to dealing with much greater risk in all of their business when compared to the kind of risk that they may face dealing with us. And I can assure you that I think we're actually a fairly stable and patient regime for them to work in.
Representative Guttenberg.
We go back, through the PPT credits. So where do the PPT credits, the ability of the industry to write off gas development on their oil and, on their oil taxes? I thought, and we had a discussion yesterday. I thought the GTP was a ability to place have deduction and downstream costs. I mean, those are considerable. I mean, there's been speculated in this building that as much as the producers could write off as much as $5 billion in development costs on gas against their oil taxes, and just looking at it just real briefly, that's a considerable advantage over anybody else coming in and having a level playing field in AGEA. And they might probably have some questions later down the road on how you build those things into the tariff, but. Can you please talk to me about that, about the PPT credits, oil against gas?
Sure,
Representative gas against oil.
Guttenberg, through the chair. First off, the PPT system is an integrated oil and gas system. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that you have costs that are deductible, deductible because of your gas production, then you deduct it against your PPT payment, which would be either for your oil and gas tax. So to the extent that you have a allowable deduction, then a gas cost could be deducted against oil production tax or create credit if you don't have any production tax. The question with regard to what constitutes a deductible gas expense comes down to what is considered to be, in the language of the PPT, a leasehold expense. And a leasehold expense is based upon what is upstream of the point of production. Point of production is ostensibly where the first meter would be, where it moves out of the control of the lessee and into some sort of a more common system. With oil, that takes place either when they go into a common carrier line or at taps. With gas, given that the gas treatment plant will be a singular entity, that meter would be at the entrance of the gas treatment plant. And so the gas treatment plant would be downstream of that point of production and would not be a deductible expense under PPT. But everything from that point, potentially upstream, would be deductible under PPT, both as a capital expense, where you get your 20%, and as a part of your ongoing expenses, the 22% deduction from your revenue.
So, if I may,
go ahead,
Mr. Chair. Yeah,
you moved
over.
Good move.
So all of the distribution lines would be able to be written off.
Potentially, as long as they're part of the system, short of that meter, and if, that point of production.
And if they build their gas treatment, I mean, they're going to sit there and look at what can we do to tax avoidance or getting around it. If they build their treatment plant into each well pad or something like that before it gets to a, so the cost when it gets to that metering building is reduced, would that still be?
Potentially, I'm not an engineer, I don't know if there's a way to build in some pre-treatment on lease pre-getting to the GTP, but they could potentially add additional costs in that sector of the development that could be deductible under PPT.
If you finish writing the regs on the PPT, is that done?
No.
Okay. And the those costs, how would those costs be written into the tariff? Is there how would that happen? I mean, the deductions, would they come out of it, or would they just not be part of it?
Representative Guttenberg, let me turn that over to Don, because he'll have a better idea of how FERC would treat tax credits.
With a limited knowledge of how the PPT actually works, a producer's tax credits associated with a GTP, I'm not sure I have an answer. I don't know enough about the PPT mechanics, I honestly can't give you an answer.
To stump the stars, I guess, but that's
fine. low bar.
No, low, real low bar.
But Representative Guttenberg will take a look at that and try to get back to you,
thank you,
with an answer. Moving on, next slide, Kevin.
This slide gets to the point of how PPT will, I believe, work to the advantage of the state. We are creating a system now that rather is a prescription or a definition of a set of terms for the state and for the applicants in a form of a contract. What we've done here is laid out a set of requirements and then that are relatively general, that in certain places we've been rather specific in terms of setting out expansion provisions and tariff and other kinds of settings, but to leave the marketplace to, or allow the marketplace to generate the most creative solutions to these issues. And an example that comes to mind is how overrun risk will be balanced and shared between the pipeline and the upstream shippers. for example. The other thing that the must-haves do is to provide a framework in a GIA, not only between the state and the pipeline owner, and for that matter, the lessees or the resource owners, it also creates a framework between the pipeline and itself, the pipeline itself, and the resource owners, and among those who are competing for the application. It's important to realize that we're setting out a mechanism that levels the playing field and also creates a setting where all the players get onto the field when you want to see them. And so those must-haves actually do that, in my belief, and create a setting where the state will, at the end of the day, achieve some critical values out of the pipeline in terms of expansion, in-state use of gas, jobs, low tariffs, and so forth, by bringing all of the parties together in a competitive setting. And the evaluative criteria is intended to establish that by setting out, first of all, a mechanism in which we will say, what does this mean for the state in terms of potential revenue, and balance that against whether or not the pipeline applicant can really deliver. Are they able to achieve that? What is their application reasonable and feasible?
So next we're going to just return back to FERC for a couple quick slides that talk about, we're not going to go into detail with this one because I think we've already covered it to a large extent in response to questions, but I want Don to focus on some Alaska particular aspects of FERC, but also to talk about how the risk associated with that initial open season can be shared between the pipe company and those initial shippers, because I think that sometimes gets lost in the discussion that we have here.
Well, first of all, Commissioner Galvin has pointed out, we've touched on most of this slide already. But you can, basically, as I said before, you have the narrowing range of uncertainty as you go through this process. And this really sets up the order of events. You have the open season that has to be pre-approved by the FERC. It results in binding solicitations of capacity, precedent agreements which define the limits of which parties are willing to commit. And then you go from there to the FERC certification process. And that involves a very detailed project description, along with all the environmental research and mitigation that has gone on to support the environmental requirements that the FERC has to satisfy. And the FERC has to also make a finding that the project is required by the present public convenience and necessity. Now, uniquely in the context of Alaska, the Congress has already established that this pipeline is required by the public convenience and necessity. That was codified in their 2004 legislation. And in fact, about 2 weeks ago, representatives of the FERC, when they testified to the House Oil and Gas Committee, confirmed that this is a unique pipeline from that standpoint. The rates for pipelines in the lower 48 are divided into two categories: recourse rates and negotiated rates. And recourse rate is the default rate, it's the cost-based, it's the conventional rate that the RCA would establish, and then what the FERC looks at the actual cost of the pipeline. FERC also allows for negotiated rates, where a willing buyer of capacity and a willing seller of capacity meet and agree on price terms that are agreeable to the two of them, so long as the shipper always has available to him access to that recourse or default rate. Now, these negotiated rates, the Commission encourages parties in new projects and parties in expansions to negotiate between themselves the risks of cost overruns, how those will be shared between the pipeline and the shipper. And certainly in one recent example on the Rockies Express pipeline project, the company offered fixed rates for the full term of the contract for 10 years as a negotiated rate option as an alternative to a recourse rate that was subject to change in future rate cases. And the negotiated rate had the effect that if the pipeline overruns its cost estimate, the pipeline company is going to have to bear, and its shareholders are going to have to bear the risks of that cost overrun. And this Rockies Express pipeline is a major west-to-east pipeline project currently under construction to move gas from Wyoming into Ohio. And it's forget the price tag, it's a $4 or $5 billion pipeline project. And FERC has to approve the negotiated rates at the end of the day.
Representative Seaton.
Is there anything in here where the state's position is supporting negotiated rates? I mean, I think back on TAPS and our settlement agreement didn't, I think, work out very well for us. So is there a state bias, or is there a state preclusion or a state veto, or is this simply we're out of the picture?
The AGIA contemplates commercial activities being structured around commercially reasonable terms. There's no state veto on this, although I suppose the state as a participant could exercise its right to comment on the setting of the recourse rate, certainly, and on any negotiated rate. But it would be expected in the context of a project like this that most of the initial shippers will go forth under negotiated rates as opposed to recourse rates.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't know if this is exactly the point this fits, but let's say we go to open season and the producers that have basically our gas decide to wait it out, and Shell comes forward and bids for the capacity. What is the state's position out? I mean, we have no production tax and we have no royalty. So basically we're giving $500 million worth of inducements for a pipeline to, and we have no recovery. Is there some contemplation here?
Representative Seaton, I guess this actually is a good transition into the next slide. What we recognize with AGIA is we're giving participants multiple opportunities to choose to participate. If we have a scenario where a pipeline is proposed and we have a company that is willing to commit their gas to the line, even though they're going to have to incur significant development costs in order to be able to get that gas into the line, I think that begs the question, why would we possibly have our lessees willing to put gas in the line when they wouldn't have to incur those same development costs? I just don't see that as a realistic scenario, given the fact that when you get down to it, if you have an economic project and you're going to be able to move forward with it becoming, you know, a reality, and you've got the opportunity for the existing producers who are sitting on known reserves that are currently cycling, and you've got explorers that are also looking at that same opportunity. The explorers have much more of a hurdle to overcome in terms of commercializing their gas than the producers would. And so I just don't see the scenario playing out where we would get a line filled with OCS gas as our initial product. It's just not just doesn't make any sense. What we are providing here, and we've talked about it to in great detail already, is the fact that AGEA provides multiple opportunities for the producers in particular to participate, but also at that initial application phase where we're putting up the initial inducement to get the license to move forward with the project, we're making it available to the producers, to the third-party pipeline companies, to other entities that may come forward with their proposals. And that will move the project ahead. We will have an open season. And at that point, there's an opportunity again for the producers to decide to participate by committing their gas to the line. We may have explorers that may come in and decide to participate. We may have gas purchasers, people who are the consumers, who may decide to participate through a purchase at the wellhead, and they would agree to ship the gas. As we're trying to create opportunities for the project to move forward, we're again trying to structure AGEA so that these participants all see opportunities at these different stages to where it's in their commercial interest to make a decision that moves this project ahead. At that initial open season, we're providing significant upstream inducements to try to get those producers to play. We're very eagerly trying to get participation in this project, but again, it has to be in the context of something that will work for the state. So as we move through this process, we talk about eliminating the unknowns, about identifying the actual project at the open season. The project will be more clear than it is today. There may still be some level of uncertainty associated with some aspects of the project. Through the negotiated rate making, some of that uncertainty can be mitigated between the pipeline and the shippers, but it may still not be there to get the commitment that's needed. And that's why we feel very strongly that we need to get a commitment right from the outset from our licensee that they will not use that as a sign of failure, that they will move forward if they have an economic project, if they have one that will provide a reasonable return for a producer. They will move this project forward and, as Don indicated, move through the FERC certificate process that would further define and lock in those uncertainties so that at the end of that process we have even more of the area of uncertainty of this project eliminated so that we can have a discussion. Again, it would be an economic project. Otherwise, under the terms of AGEA, it likely would have been dropped at some point along the way. And we can have the discussion about a project that actually has a FERC certificate that's ready to go. And we believe with a significant amount of confidence that the producers, as rational players in this process, are going to recognize the opportunity at each step of this process and see that it is in their interests as well to participate. And I know that a comment that Representative Rose has made earlier was facetious in the sense that if the producers realize that with the noose around their neck and as they're being walked off the plank that they have to make this commitment, we don't see it as that at all. What we're seeing is we're basically clarifying the playing field so that they can see clearly that they have an opportunity to move forward with this project and that it's in their interest to do so. And we believe that at that time they will make that decision.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Perhaps this is, I'm not sure who would best answer this. In the FERC ruling in the 2005, there's a section on an in-state needs study.
There's another section on methodology of determining value of bids for deliveries in the state. Would those be appropriate in a GEA? Would those sections mean anything? If somebody looking at a GEA, let's say a Fairbanks developer, a gas distributor, would be better off seeing that done for developing markets before an open season. Would that be an appropriate place to put this into a GEA?
The FERC ruling that you're referring to requires that what I'll call a FERC compliant open season must have been preceded by this in-state study, and also requires, as does a GEA, distance sensitive rates for deliveries in Alaska. So that's already a part of the requirements, federal requirements. Your question is, should we add the in-state study to the AGEA must-haves? I don't know. Certainly the AGEA requirement that there be distance sensitive rates for in-state deliveries is I think where the real concern for Alaskans, along with the in-state delivery points, that Alaskans I think are pretty well protected there.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, my point was to have it, even though it's going to be done down the road, FERC, wouldn't it be advantageous to Alaska to have it done sooner? Somebody knows it's going to have to be done for the FERC certificate, but for part of the AGEA, it would be done sooner, and maybe it would be to our advantage.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I guess two parts of that. One is, I believe the in-state demand study has to be done before the open season under the FERC rules, and so it wouldn't be all the way at the end of the process. But we clearly recognize that in-state demand is meeting in-state demand is an important part of our natural gas pipeline policy as a state. Within the sequence of events, what we recognize also is that we need the pipeline to move forward as quickly as possible. We need to have the in-state demand have the opportunity to, if it can, catch up to that initial open season. But most significantly, in-state demand is likely to be met through the expansion and the opportunities for future future expansion, future open seasons for in-state use. I think that when we were looking at how to meet in-state demand in a GEA, we were focused on long-term issues. We wanted to make sure that we embedded in there the offtake points, the distance-sensitive tariffs, the expansion provisions, so that Alaska's long-term in-state use can be met. I think that the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority has done in-state studies. I know that they have expressed concern with regard to the level to which the state will be ready to participate in an initial open season. I think from our perspective, we agree that getting the state ready for meeting the in-state demand is a interesting and vital thing to pursue, and I think the House version has the gasification revolving loan program that was put in by the previous committee. At some point, you've got to decide, you know, where your initial priorities lie. We want to get the project moving. We want to get to an initial open season, and we don't want to necessarily have that slow down because of a need for an additional study or something if that's not going to actually meet in-state demand in a timely manner. but I think it's worth looking at in terms of where we stand on how to meet both of our goals.
Just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Gell. You know, for somebody that lives in a town with an oil pipeline and a refinery, and knowing that I pay high national averages for my petroleum products, I think it is in the best state's best interest. Both, I mean, getting it moving is certainly considerable, but for planning for having the most optimal use for around the state should be something that should be considered, because the gas prices in Anchorage are going to be different under this project than what you're experiencing now.
And I think the propane and the ability to service villages and PTE and BCE, and there'll be several things that'll happen once we get a pipeline in place. We'll have a lot more to do. Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you. Yesterday we talked a little bit about CO2 and as an evaluation criteria or as a criteria in the and you said you guys were working on it. I didn't hear anything in this presentation yet. Do you have
24 hours?
Yeah, 24 hours.
We've been producing CO2 all these 24 hours.
I've been producing a lot of it in the last couple hours.
I got you when you're going to be here instead of on the other side.
Okay. Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, we are definitely interested in working with you on addressing that issue. We are looking at a number of different ways in order to address it, both in terms of what may or may not be needed in the bill through intent language, through the RFA, where it actually fits. But we do intend to work with you on making sure that those concerns are met and that we have environmentally friendly project at the end. It's just a matter of where it needs to be in there.
Okay.
And just follow up.
Go ahead.
And I guess I just wanted to, there's a chairman here had Chevron managing energy portfolio, and I'd just like to point out that on page 10 they say that they've installed California's first megawatt class hydrogen fuel cell cogeneration plant. So there are some other options, and not wanting to limit them, I don't know what the other companies are talking about, but it's just one of those things that I appreciate working with you on that.
It came out of their annual report, Chevron's annual report. Beautiful document, very glossy, beautiful pictures of happy people, and they always like to brag about how innovative they are and how productive they are, and I think they talked about a 45% return. Almost fell out of my chair.
Well, it's been some good years for
they were. Right.
Well, we'll be addressing that question when we deal with oil companies.
Go ahead.
Forgive me, but may I ask a question of Representative Seaton? It uses methane, doesn't it?
Sure, and as long as you're not releasing methane or fugitive CO2, that's what we're trying to get at, is so that we're not looking at a cap and trade or something that could impact negatively the pipeline. So it's an interesting thing if we have fuel cell technology that doesn't release methane, that actually uses methane for the hydrogen source. But as long as we're not releasing CO2, that's the whole purpose of getting around addressing this somehow as a criteria.
The CO2 in the raw material, and there's the CO2 we create in moving it. Yeah. I mean, in burning the gas in the compressors, never mind all the vehicles and whatnot that are required. So a couple of places there. But we'll get to that environmental issue soon enough.
Yes. And just the summary slide, again, going back to the beginning of the presentation, the AGEA sets up a commercial vehicle geared towards leveling the playing field, having competition, having a transparent process, meets the state's needs, geared towards expansion, low cost, using the commercial interest in the project to try to resolve some of the issues that are facing us in terms of dealing with the hurdles associated with this project. And in the end, it's an opportunity for the participants to come and play. And that's something we haven't actually spent any time discussing, is talking about the opportunity. AGEA sets up an opportunity to get the state inducements in exchange for something in return. Clearly, any project is free to move forward without any state participation. They can just go forward with the project, and AGEA doesn't preclude that. But we believe that it does provide the best mechanism for the state to participate in this project, so that in the end we have the greatest likelihood of the project moving forward in a timely manner with the terms that are favorable to the state's long-term future.
And that is really a dandy way. There is a question we have from Representative Johnson here.
And it was sort of, it's about FERC and the ability to on the tariffs. So I'm kind of going back a few slides. Can you do a rolled in and an incremental rate request? You know, and what I'm thinking about is Shell, because we don't get any tariffs, we don't get any tax, oil taxes. Is there a way that we can have maybe treat companies differently in the expansion, where maybe they are an incremental because we don't, the state doesn't reap any benefits? Or, I mean, I'm trying to look out and trying to get the money for the state here, and I don't want to see us starting to pay more tariffs without generating any additional revenue because we're dealing with this entity that we have no real control over. So I wonder if there's a way is that something that FERC even looks at? Is that way out in left field?
That's going to be a policy call, Representative Johnson. Technically, yes, you can do a partial roll-in. You can roll in up to a certain amount and an incremental above that amount.
So the 15%, for example,
above 15%,
you can increment the rest.
I thought that was your.
Well, that's kind of where I was
but
going.
But yeah. Technically, yeah, mechanically, you can do that. The FERC is going to look at this at the end of the day, though, and say, we don't have the same interest that the state of Alaska does on this. We're looking out for the consumers in the lower 48 and the other shippers on the system. And so I think the FERC is going to be following their policy of favoring rolled-in pricing for any expansion, regardless of whether it benefits the state of Alaska directly or not.
You know, I'm going to throw a party when we're at that point where we've got this pipe in the ground, we're pumping all this gas, and now we're worried about how we get any more gas into this pipe.
Not another party.
I might be retired by then. So you've concluded your presentation?
That's the conclusion of our presentation. We're still ready and willing and able to answer questions.
Yeah. I appreciate it.
Today or
bringing
in the future.
Shepler and having with you also. And I think we'll probably be seeing you again sometime later down the road here. So that as more questions come up from talking to producers, talking to consumers, talking to whomever we have to talk to here, that when we come up with any kind of questions, then I think I'm going to see if we can get them back for answering the tough ones. As we develop the tough questions that we can't get from anyone else, we'll say, hey, it's your pipe, your goal, your AGEA plan, I want an answer. And I bet you're going to be okay with that.
Oh, yes.
All right.
We're more than happy to talk about
appreciate you
why we're doing this.
With that, unless there is another question, the meeting is adjourned.